Shalom, Hadavarnex. Well, we're ready to start our next session of the First Regathering Modern Israel. This will be session 38. It'll be on page 319 of your notebook, page 319. So let's do a quick review regarding where we were when we finished up our last session. With a number of topics we covered, one, of course, was the death of Leah Rabin at age 72. She was laid to rest beside her husband. Here is the photograph of the marker of their graves, Leah Rabin's grave marked with the white stone, and Yitzhak Rabin marked with the dark stone. Shortly after that event, Ariel Sharon was elected Prime Minister of Israel. At that time, Israel was going through a severe drought, and you can see from this picture of the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret, that the lake, Israel's major freshwater source of supply, was very low. All these people should be standing underwater, and yet you can see they are on a beach. And this graph shows you the problems with the drought over the from 2004 to 2012. The drought had been going on since around 2002. But as you can see from this chart, the level of the Kinneret stays primarily below the upper red line and above the lower red line. And then in 2009, the water level dropped. In 2009 and 2010, the water level dropped down dangerously close to the black line, which is the time when the lake will become polluted. So Israel was going through a definite water shortage at that time. The Mitchell Report was convened to look into the Intifada, and the Mitchell Report came up with a number of recommendations. First of all, they recommended a cessation of violence. Secondly, they recommended that there be a resumption of security cooperation between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. They then suggested 10 points that would rebuild confidence between the two entities, the State of Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And then they urged that the two would resume negotiations. In 2001, as we entered 2001, the United States suffered 9/11. The attack upon the World Trade Center. Israel identified with that attack because they were the victims of terrorism. And even though there was some Palestinian regret, other Palestinians rejoiced in that attack. The Karine A, a Palestinian-owned ship, was intercepted with many, many tons of armament on board, bound for the Palestinian Authority. It was a Palestinian Authority-owned ship. The captain was hired by the Palestinian Authority. He was part of the Palestinian Authority. The captain admitted that the illegal arms were destined for the Palestinian Authority, and yet Yasser Arafat said, "I know nothing about this. We have nothing to do with that ship. We have plenty of arms on our own." So again, just straight out and out lies. Israel suffered their first female suicide bomber during the Intifada, I forget her name now. A young lady was the first female to blow herself up trying to kill Israelis. So now every man, woman, and child would be suspect. Every man, of course, because terrorists have been men from the beginning. But then children, because the PA began using children to fight their wars in 1982, and now with Wafa Idris, that was her name, Wafa Idris killing herself, women were included as terrorists. We close speaking about the Passover bombing, the Passover massacre at the Park Hotel, and we'll be talking about the response to that massacre in just a few minutes. But at this point, I'd like to recommend that you I recommended that you view the DVD Israel in Time of Terror by Dennis Prager, available through Vanguard on Amazon.com. So this delves into an up-close and personal look at the Intifada as Israel was suffering it. All right, that brings us now to page 319 in your notebook, and March 29th, 2002. And it was March 28th, 2002, if I'm correct. Yes, March 28th, 2002, the Park Hotel bombing in Netanya occurred, the Passover massacre. The very next day, on March 29th, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon announced an extensive operational activity against Palestinian terrorism had commenced. The action was named Operation Protective Wall. It's also known as Operation Defensive Shield. There were fourfold goals to the operation. The goals were to, one, track down terror, two, destroy the terrorist infrastructure, three, confiscate weapons, and four, to arrest fugitives. Operation Defensive Shield, Protective Wall, extended from March 28, 2002 to April 19, 2002. The IDF cornered a defiant Arafat in his Ramallah compound. They blasted their way inside, and they began a room-by-room search using small arms fire and stun grenades. And here is a photograph. This is from the Los Angeles Times. The caption reads, Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat's compound in the West Bank city of Ramallah comes under fire. Israeli commandos blasted their way inside, searched room by room, and cut electricity and phone lines in a far-reaching campaign to isolate Arafat. And you can see the blasts as they blasted their way into the Ramallah compound. Now, the operation yielded documents that directly linked Arafat to Palestinian suicide bombings. Control of the entire compound was seized except for the floor of the building where Arafat lives. The army was instructed to isolate him but not take over his offices. Now, Arafat used the opportunity to grant interviews with Arabic language television stations. He stated that he wanted to become a martyr. See, the Israelis were attacking him, so he wanted to become a martyr. Now, in response to that, Michael Ramirez in the Los Angeles Times drew this cartoon. And in the cartoon, you see Arafat in the center there, surrounded by his destroyed compound, sitting at his desk, and he's looking in a mirror, and he says, in the red circle, he says, I hope God will make me a martyr. And then he concludes with, send in another woman or child to take my place. And that's so typical of these Palestinian authorities. Palestinian leaders are quite happy to send women and children to blow themselves up, but they don't seem to be too interested in it themselves. Now, during the operation, over 500 Palestinian men were detained for identification and questioning. Large stores of weapons and arms were discovered in Arafat's compound and in Ramallah. These weapons are being held by the PA in direct violation of all agreements made with Israel. If Israel's trying to implement the agreements, we see that the PA isn't. 10 terrorists on Israel's most wanted list were arrested during the operation in Ramallah. The next week, Operation Protective Wall was widened, with IDF movements into Qalqilya, Nablus, Jenin, Tulkarem, and Bethlehem. Now, here's a map of the West Bank, and let's go in for a close-up, and we'll see how Operation Protective Wall expanded. First of all, here is Ramallah in the red circle. Ramallah is where Arafat's compound is. So the Operation Protective Wall began there with the isolating of Arafat. Expanded to Qalqilya on the western edge of the West Bank. Nablus in the center of the West Bank. Jenin to the north. Tulkarem again on the western edge. And to the south, Bethlehem. These were the key the key cities harboring terrorists during this time. And notice Bethlehem. Bethlehem used to be a Arab Christian city, but it rapidly became a hotbed for Islamic terrorism as they began to persecute the Christians and push them out. And last time I was in Bethlehem, they gave us the Arabs required we use an Arab bus, of course, and they gave us an armed escort to go to the Church of the Nativity. And that's when I said, enough of this, because Bethlehem has become a hotbed of Islamic terrorism. Now, during the entire operation, Operation Protective Wall, 4,258 Palestinians were detained, 396 wanted suspects arrested. Prime Minister Sharon addressed the nation, and he said that Israel, quote, is at war on terror. We must fight against this terrorism, fight with no compromise, pull up these wild plants by the roots, smash their infrastructure, because there is no compromise with terrorism. This terrorism is used, directed, and initiated by one man, Yasser Arafat. Arafat remained confined in his windowless office, with Israel supplying food, medicine, and water to Arafat and to the people confined with him. Foreign Minister Shimon Peres stated that Israel had achieved the goals that Arafat was supposed to accomplish. See, Arafat was supposed to attack terrorism and arrest terrorists. So Israel had to go in and do it because he was not interested in following through on his commitment. Palestinian leaders said that Operation Protective Wall was simply a pretext to kill Arafat. If it was a pretext to kill him, why wasn't he killed? PA leaders even claimed the IDF was planning to storm Arafat's headquarters in an attempt to snatch the wanted men and possibly send Arafat into exile. Always Palestinian propaganda is always exaggerated to the extreme. Well, U.S. envoy Anthony Zinni met with Arafat in his Ramallah office. Arafat told Zinni that he supported the tenant plan. However, Arafat has agreed to the tenant plan time and time and time again, but has never implemented it. Arafat's pattern is to never make a major decision unless under extreme pressure. Now let's turn to page 320 now. Page 320. On April 14th, 2002, Sharon announced that the IDF would not lift the siege of Arafat until he handed over three of the alleged killers of cabinet member Ze'ev. After 34 days of confinement, the siege was lifted when Arafat agreed to a U.S. compromise for ending the confinement. Under the agreement, six terrorists, including the convicted killers of Cabinet Minister Ze'ev, will be jailed in Jericho under American and British supervision. Israel stated that the assassins are with Arafat in the compound. Now, after leaving his compound, Arafat toured the areas hit by Operation Defensive Shield. It's notable that Arafat visited the Palestinian refugee camp in Jenin. During the operation, 48 terrorists died in Jenin. So members of Islamic Jihad were angry with Arafat. They stated that he did not do enough to defend them and that they made sacrifices for the Palestinian cause while the PA did not. Now, 2 weeks after the terrorists were jailed in Jericho, the Palestinian High Court ordered the release of the leader of the PFLP. The Palestinian High Court wanted to negate the agreement in regard to this leader of the PFLP, Palestinian, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Israel was livid and promised to bring justice to him if he was released. Subsequently, the PA overruled the High Court and kept the PFLP commander behind bars because of Israeli threats. Now, Operation Protective Wall is one element providing the necessary pressure for change. On April 5th, Israeli forces killed the mastermind of the Passover massacre. The leader, Qais Oduwan, headed the military wing of Hamas in northern Samaria. On April 15th, 2002, The IDF then captured Marwan Barghouti, the Tanzim commander in the West Bank. He was considered the natural successor to Arafat. Israel holds him responsible for the Al-Aqsa Intifada and for attacks against Israelis. The IDF initially thought he was hiding in Arafat's Ramallah compound, but after seizing the compound, the Israelis discovered he was on the run. Eventually, they tracked him down to a building close to Arafat's headquarters. The IDF surrounded that building, and Barghouti surrendered without a fight. I guess he didn't want to become a martyr. He wasn't interested in martyrdom, was he? Under interrogation, Barghouti admitted to IDF forces that he directed terrorist attacks in which scores of Israelis were killed. He also revealed how he allocated the needed funds to the terror cells and purchased the necessary weapons. The arrest of Barghouti and other top-level Fatah activists and hundreds of rank-and-file Fatah activists produced information directly linking Arafat and terrorism. Their statements were supported by a vast number of documents seized from PA offices. For example, those requiring financial support needed to have their request authorized by Arafat. Also, the names of potential Tanzim activists were submitted to Barghouti, who then took them to Arafat for approval. So Yasser Arafat was very much involved in terrorism. All right, bottom of page 320, we come to April 2nd, 2002, and the Bethlehem siege. On April 2nd, 2002, Israeli tanks and troops rolled into Bethlehem as part of Operation Protective Wall. In response, some 200 Palestinians, many of them armed, stormed into the famous Church of the Nativity. And the Israeli army besieged them for 39 days, page 321. This standoff between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian militants at this well-known holy site captured the world's attention. Entering the compound is an old practice of Palestinian militants because they know that the IDF is under orders not to harm holy places. Places of worship are offered special protection in accordance with international law. This action by the terrorists is a direct violation of the Geneva Conventions to its additional protocols. Israel demanded that the militants either surrender or be tried in an Israeli military court or be expelled from the country forever. The siege was prolonged as various European countries refused to accept the terrorists. They didn't want them on their soil either. Eventually, 13 militants were exiled to Cyprus, 26 sent to the Gaza Strip. Residents of Bethlehem were relieved, stating that these men had imposed a two-year reign of terror in the city that included rape, extortion, and executions. And of course, with Bethlehem being originally primarily an Arab Christian city, this was the way the Muslim fundamentalists were driving Arab Christians out of the city. Rape, extortion, and executions. All right, page 321. April 3rd, 2002, Jenin refugee camp invaded, Israel accused of a massacre. April 3rd, 2002, Israeli tanks rolled into Jenin as part of Operation Defensive Shield. They encountered stiff resistance in this bastion of terrorism, this breeding ground for suicide bombers. Many of the militants were associated with Islamic Jihad. Now, you have this map on your note. Here's a map of Jenin. Jenin, remember, is the northernmost city of one of the northernmost cities in the West Bank. And this is a map of Jenin. In the left lower corner, in the red box, you can see a map of the old city. The dark area on the left side of the map is the refugee camp itself. And, of course, the refugee camp itself is enlarged in the map proper. So this is the area of Jenin that was most affected by Operation Defensive Shield. Now, this is where the Israeli troops entered first, and there was heavy fighting in this area of the refugee camp. As they went into Jenin, The IDF encountered booby-trap buildings and alleyways and bodies. Booby-trap buildings, booby-trapped alleyways, and booby-trapped bodies, corpses. A very typical situation the soldiers encountered would be to approach a three-story building. The door and the first floor would be blanketed with booby traps. On the second floor, once they got through the booby traps, the soldiers would find a couple of civilian families, around 12 people, who were effectively barricaded in by the booby traps. In other words, the Islamic fundamentalists put them on the second floor and then laid down booby traps on the first floor, and they didn't dare go out. Then on the third floor would be around five terrorists who would be shooting down on the soldiers. So these terrorists had provided themselves with two layers of defense. The first layer was booby traps. The second layer was civilians. They figured that would keep them safe. Palestinian media began producing allegations concerning IDF interference with sick, wounded, and dead, and the systematic destruction of houses, and a massacre in Jenin. In contrast, the IDF continued its policy of providing humanitarian aid as well as food, water, and medicines to civilians in the West Bank and Gaza. On April 12, 2002, the United States Secretary of State, Colin Powell, said that Israel had a right to defend itself. Quote, "We have responded to terrorism. We know that Israel has a right to respond to terrorism." And of course, the background of that is 9/11. On the seventh day of the operation, a platoon of Israeli soldiers from the 5th Brigade were ambushed in a plaza. Almost the entire platoon was wiped out during the two-hour fight, 13 killed, 6 wounded. Here's our map again, and the red oval shows the area of most severe, heaviest fighting and destruction, and the black star. The black star is where the 13 Israeli soldiers were killed in an ambush. I hope you can see that. The black star located right in this location right here. This is where the 13 Israelis were ambushed. The ambush proved to the IDF that the militants holed up in the surrounding buildings could only be extracted with a great loss of life. And from that moment on, they changed their tactics. Foot patrols and house-to-house searches were discontinued. Instead, armored bulldozers were brought in and used to crush any home believed to be the source of enemy fire. And here is a photograph of the type of bulldozer that Israel used, a bulldozer that is covered with armor plating, keep the driver safe, and they would just bulldoze buildings to the ground. And here is a picture from the Los Angeles Times of the area of Jenin, of the refugee camp, that suffered the most damage. And, of course, not all the refugee camp looked like this, only a small portion of it. But you can see the bulldozers are quite effective at destroying the homes. And, again, this is the area where the heaviest destruction occurred, right in this area here, about a third of the refugee camp was involved in this kind of activity. Now, the incursion lasted until April 19, 2002, when Israeli forces completed their withdrawal from Jenin. President Bush praised Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for meeting the timetable for withdrawal that he had set. Arafat's lack of desire to halt terrorism was highlighted by the fact that the Israeli government had presented U.S. peace envoy Anthony Zinni with a list of 33 most wanted terrorists in December of 2001, 4 months earlier. The list was subsequently given by Zinni to the Palestinians. These men were not arrested, nor were they detained. As a result, 5 of Israel's most wanted terrorists were arrested during Operation Defensive Shield, and 3 had been killed. Israel stated that about 70 Palestinians, mostly gunmen, were killed in Jenin. All right, we're on page 323. And this is a mark-it-up moment here, the top of page 323. Note this, what's happening here. April 15th, 2002, The initial Palestinian claim was that Israel had perpetrated a massacre and hundreds killed, including many civilians. On April 30th, the Palestinians had claimed that 3,000 people had been killed. Now, in order to substantiate the claim, the Palestinians began adding bodies to the mass graves that contained the bodies of 26 people who were killed during the incursion. How did they do that? They removed bodies from the local cemetery and moved them over to this other graveyard. The IDF also caught a staged burial on film. They wanted to, you know, add a number, so let's stage a burial, add that number to the total. A drone filmed a group of Palestinians carrying a body on a stretcher, and that burial was being filmed by a cameraman for the media, so the media could broadcast that. Look at all these people have been killed. Here's one being buried. Well, the stretcher bearers stumbled, and the body fell to the ground. Then the corpse got up and returned to the stretcher, and off they walked. But after a second fall, the corpse was a little upset. This time, the corpse walked off in a huff. So much for the Palestinian propaganda. On May 1st, 2002, an American human rights group, Physicians for Human Rights, released a report stating the evidence did not point to a massacre. The death toll was finally determined to be 7 civilians, 48 terrorists, 55 Palestinians, while Israel suffered 29 dead and 127 wounded. The UN did investigate the Jenin operation in response to false Palestinian propaganda regarding this alleged massacre. In August, the resulting Secretary General's report overwhelmingly negated the Palestinian fabrication. And here's a cartoon dramatizing that report. Kofi Annan there is reading a paper entitled UN Report Jenin, and he states, "I'm sorry, there was no massacre in Jenin." And there is Yasser Arafat on the right with his left hand holding a bomb and his right hand bloodied. And he says, "As usual, the UN favors Israel." The UN favors Israel. Yeah, right, you guys. The report specifically refutes the claim made by senior Palestinian Authority official alleging the massacre of 500 civilians. The UN report stated that no more than 52 people died in Jenin, most of them armed individuals. Now, page 323, a question of blood. The piece is entitled A Question of Blood. It's written by Dan Gordon, and it appeared in the Jewish Journal May 29, 2002. Dan Gordon is a former sergeant in the IDF, the author of 5 books, and a screenwriter. He was in Jenin on April 16th and was told a story by Dr. David Zangen, chief medical officer of the Israeli paratroop unit, the paratroop unit that bore the brunt of the fighting in Jenin. Dr. Zangen said that the IDF not only worked to keep the Palestinian hospital open, they offered the Palestinians blood for their wounded. The Palestinians refused the offer of blood because it was Jewish blood. Now, the Israelis, who could not be faulted for saying, "Well, you don't like it? Do without it," instead flew in 2,000 units of blood from Jordan, Arab blood, via helicopters. In addition, they saw to it that 40 units of blood from the Mukassad Hospital in East Jerusalem went to the hospital in Ramallah, and that 70 units got to the hospital in Tulkarem. On top of that, they facilitated the delivery of 1,800 units of anticoagulants that had come from Morocco, all Arab sources. The information was later confirmed by Colonel Arik Gordon of the IDF office, military spokesman, who supplied the exact number of units and the names of the hospitals to which they were delivered. All right, page 324. Dan Gordon concludes. Now, pay attention to this conclusion. So the question to ponder, how do you negotiate with a hatred so great that it will refuse to accept your blood even to save its own people's lives? How does an international community vilify a nation that offers its own blood to its enemies while its own soldiers lay dying? And that when faced with race hatred that brands their blood unfit. They divert military flights to bring blood more suitable to the taste of those who would destroy them. Israel is not an apartheid and racist nation, to say the least. All right, I think it's about time for your break. So we'll pick it up on page 324 with Arafat Weekend and the PA and promoting reform in the PA. So take your break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Alrighty, let's get back to where we were. We're picking up our class on page 324. At the top of the page there, the headline says, Arafat Weekend Promotes PA Reform. Yasser Arafat and the PA, badly weakened from Operation Defensive Shield, came under pressure from the international community to reform. Moderate Arab states such as Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia began to see Arafat as the problem, not the solution, and were pressing for reform. Arafat also faced unprecedented domestic criticism. Operation Defensive Shield caused additional economic hardship for the Palestinian Arabs. Dissatisfaction with Arafat became more and more visible. Early in July, a significant demonstration occurred. The demonstration involved approximately 10,000 Palestinians. They demonstrated in Gaza, blaming the PA for the disastrous economic situation rather than Israel. Now that's a switch, isn't it? Blaming the PA rather than Israel for something. At one point, about 4,000 began marching toward Arafat's offices, but were stopped by the PA police. More and more PA officials began talking about lost opportunities and a normal life, and a desire to change direction. Fatah demanded that Arafat, appoint a prime minister to handle the day-to-day affairs of state. Arafat would remain the symbol of the Palestinian cause, but would no longer be the only one calling the shots. Accordingly, on Nakba Day 2002, he called for sweeping reforms in his government and for new elections. The new elections were scheduled for mid-January 2003. Well, in reality, his government reforms were less than sweeping. Arafat trimmed his cabinet from 32 ministers down to 21. Not much. Here's a cartoon that dramatizes that little shake-up in the government. Arafat shakes up the government. We have before. Before, the government is made up of 32 Arafat clones. The bottom picture is after. The government is now made up of 21 Arafat clones. Not a lot of difference. Well, two significant changes occurred. First of all, Arafat stepped down as interior minister. He appointed a new interior minister who will oversee Palestinian security forces, removing Jibril Rajoub from that position. A behind-the-scenes power struggle between Jibril Rajoub and Mohammed Dahlan, the Gaza security chief, appeared. A supporter of Rajoub's rival was beaten by five masked men outside his Ramallah house. Arafat's dismissal of Rajoub threw the PA into turmoil. Rajoub's 4,000 armed men refused to accept Rajoub's replacement, page 325. In addition, the Palestinian police chief Ghazi al-Jabali in Gaza has decided to run against Arafat in the January election. The fact that a senior Palestinian is willing to run against Arafat is another indicator that Arafat's hold on power is slipping. All right, April 17, 2002, Israel's 54th Independence Day. And there's some statistics for Israel on 2002. The current population was 6.5 million in 2002, 8 times larger than 1948. The Jewish population was 81% of the nation, 5.2 million. The Arab population was 19% of the nation, 1.2 million. 2.9 million, almost 3 million immigrants had come in since 1948. And Israel in 2002 accounted for 37% of the worldwide Jewish population. The U.S. At that time was still the largest center for the Jewish population in the world at 40% of the worldwide Jewish population. All right, June 17th, 2002, the 34th Zionist Congress in Jerusalem. As the 34th Zionist Congress gathered, a poll indicates that the majority of Palestinians favor the destruction of the State of Israel. 51% said that the result of the conflict should be the liberating of all historic Palestine. 71% supported terrorist attacks against civilians, and 48% supported attacks against Israel. So, even though it was only the 34th Zionist Congress, we still have tremendous opposition against Israel. Israel begins building security fence. Israel decided to build a 217-mile fence designed to shield it from suicide bombers. And here is the 2003 status of the fence, the security fence. The security fence, the red, operates here. The security fence is pretty much finished in the northern part of the West Bank at this time. Comes down to this area. The blue area that I'm now starting is the approved path of the wall. The wall will continue through here. It is finished in this area. And the approved path comes, of course, all the way down. And the yellow area, of course, is Palestinian-controlled territory. So the separation wall was just underway with a small part of it under construction to the north. To the north, that was the most important area to build a security fence. In 2011, the fence had moved along quite a bit. Of course, it was finished now in the north. You can see the red line here of the security fence, and now it comes all the way down. All the way down to this area, to Jerusalem, and then from Jerusalem it is completed. There's a few areas here that's not completed. It's completed all the way down, rounding the southern tip of the West Bank. So by 2011, the security fence was just about completed. Now, Arafat rejected the fence, calling it fascist and apartheid. The fence is meant to provide security, not form a border. It will consist of fences, walls, ditches, patrol roads, and electronic surveillance devices. Here's a picture of a typical area of the fence. The vast majority of the fence, I think a good 90% of it, is a barbed wire chain link fence. Now here, in Bethlehem, you can see the small portion of the fence, and there are, and it only is a small portion that is made up of very high concrete walls. And of course, that is the pictures you always see in the media of the fence, making it appear as though the Palestinians are behind something like the Berlin Wall. It's a nice propaganda piece because the Palestinians write and make drawings all over it and write messages all over it, and make it seem like Israel is truly an apartheid state. But that's not the reason for the high concrete barrier located in only specific areas, a small number of specific areas in the whole security fence operation. Notice that this very high wall runs right along a road. Notice the road runs along the base of it, and on the other side of the wall are high buildings. Now, that's important because this is the purpose for the concrete barriers. It is to protect people, Israelis, driving on the along the road from snipers. So you see in this diagram, the sniper, the cars will drive in the shadow of the concrete wall, in the bullet shadow. The snipers cannot, bullets cannot touch them. So it's to create a bullet shadow of safety and security for the Israelis. And again, now as you can see again, we're back to the original picture. You can see how snipers would want to climb up on those buildings and fire down on the road, but because the road protects the cars driving on it, it makes for us a good security barrier. That's the purpose for this barrier. Now here is the way most of the security fence is put together. Like 90% of it is a chain link fence. You see on one side, you have on the left side is the west bank, and there's a ditch to prevent the vehicles from crashing into the fence. Then there's a patrol road. Then there's the fence itself with intrusion detection devices attached to it. Then there's an intrusion tracking dirt road. That dirt road is soft dirt that is smoothed every day. And if someone climbs the fence, because it is just a chain link fence, they have to walk across this soft sand road, and that leaves deep tracks. It's very obvious that they have crossed the chain link fence. Then there's the patrol road for the Israeli patrols, and they drive along the patrol route looking for evidence of someone climbing over the barrier. And then there is another intrusion tracking dirt road on the right. If an intruder does climb the wall, he has to go through soft dirt, which will leave tracks on both sides of the patrol road. And once those tracks are spotted, the hunt is on. The hunt is on. So it's a very effective way of spotting intruders and going after them. But remember, a good 90% or more of the security fence is indeed a chain link fence. It is not concrete barriers. In fact, here's a picture of some of the barbed wire that makes up that security fence. It's a chain link and barbed wire. But of course, you can't draw cartoons and write slogans on barbed wire, can you? All righty. The fence will cost $200 million. It's expected to be completed in less than a year. So this is, where are we at now? We're in 2002. Well, it took longer than that to construct it. The United States also criticized the decision. Immediately, the fence came under attack by gunmen south of Afula. There was no damage or casualties, and construction was only temporarily halted. An additional 30-mile-long electronic fence is going up. This fence will protect three sides of Jerusalem with the aim of keeping suicide bombers out of the city. Page 326. Now, in the years to come, the value of the security fence has been clearly demonstrated. Israeli government sources have stated that since the barrier has been built, Israeli security has improved with regard to suicide bombings. According to statistics published by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Israeli Security Agency, from the beginning of the Second Intifada until the construction of the first continuous segment of the barrier in July 2003, 73 Palestinian suicide bombings were carried out in the West Bank, from the West Bank. That's a very important word, from. The suicide bombers came from the West Bank, 73 of them. They killed 293 Israelis and injured over 1,900. However, between August 2003 and the end of 2006, 2.5 years, only 12 attacks were carried out that were based in the West Bank. They killed 64 Israelis and wounded 445. The downward trend continued in 2007 and 2008 as well. The number of fatalities due to terrorist attacks have continued to exhibit a steady decline since 2002, from 452 in 2002 to 9 in 2010. So this chart illustrates and dramatizes these statistics. The West Bank security fence was started in 2002, and there were a tremendous number of attacks. And then as the bank, the West Bank barrier, was completed, the number of bomb attacks from the West Bank dropped considerably. So the value of this security fence has been substantiated over time. It is not an apartheid barrier. All right, June 24th, in the middle of 2002, Operation Determined Path. In mid-June, a wave of suicide attacks killed 30 Israelis. In response, Israel launched a new operation dubbed Determined Path. Coordinated with Operation Determined Path came a significant change in Israeli strategy. The two came together, strategy change and Determined Path. Israel will now respond to acts of terror by capturing PA territory. The territory will be held as long as terror continues, and more attacks will lead to Israel taking more territory. Now, the change was not without criticism. A long-term reoccupation of territory means Israel becomes responsible for everything from health to sewage. And such a responsibility would pose an incredible burden upon Israel. Yasser Arafat fruitlessly called for an end to terror attacks and asked that President Bush implement the end of the Madrid conference. The remarks were not made on TV or radio, and so they had limited exposure. Arafat also announced that he was willing to accept the December 2000 Camp David Clinton peace plan, in which 95% of the West Bank was offered to the PA. See, so now he's all ready to accept that offer, something that he refused back in 2000. In addition, the PA announced that presidential and parliamentary elections would be held in mid-January 2003. Folks, they never happened. Instead of a warm welcome for his turnabout, President Bush urged the Palestinians to replace Yasser Arafat and adopt a practicing democracy leading to an independent state in 3 years. So what Bush did, President Bush replaced the land for peace doctrine of the last 35 years with a democracy for statehood doctrine. Kind of a different carrot being handed out. President Bush's statement was flatly rejected by the Palestinian leadership. They didn't want, Yasser Arafat did not want to be replaced. Yasser Arafat even denied that he was the man in question. You know, President Bush is not talking about me. I should not be replaced. He has no shame, doesn't he? Or he had no shame, did he? Just he would lie like a rug. The Arab world reacted with official silences from governments and expressions of outrage from the Arab media. Page 327. July 2000, the founder of Hamas's military wing is assassinated. An Israeli warplane fired a missile that flattened a Gaza City apartment building, killing Salah Shahadeh, the founder and top commander of the Hamas military wing. The wing, known as the Izzaddin al-Qassam, has carried out the largest number of suicide attacks against Israelis of the al-Aqsa Intifada. Israeli security forces describe Shahadeh as a deeply religious man, a fervent supporter of suicide bombings, and a possible successor to Ahmed Yassin, who was leading Hamas at that time. Deeply religious. A religion of peace, a religion that promotes suicide bombings. Doesn't quite compute with our way of thinking, does it? The attack also killed 14 other Palestinians, including many children. But please note, Israel does all it can to avoid civilian casualties, as evidenced by the fact that this was the first such incident with such a high toll in 22 months of fighting. In contrast to Palestinian attitudes, the Israeli army immediately opened an investigation to find out what went wrong. The operation was approved only after intelligence information indicated that no civilians were in the area. So it was a tragic mistake, a tragic damage, collateral damage from this attack. Had the intelligence information been correct, the attack never would have occurred. September 2002, Israel is winning the Al-Aqsa Intifada. By September 2002, the momentum of the Al-Aqsa Intifada had turned to Israel's favor. The intended effect of the Intifada was to demoralize the nation, demoralize Israel. However, it had done quite the opposite. The nation of Israel, was experiencing a sense of resolve and unity the likes of which it had not experienced in decades. In contrast, the Palestinians' own violence was causing them to suffer, to lose ground, and to have doubts for three reasons. Number one, Palestinian impoverishment. Huge economic losses had been suffered, with unemployment variously estimated between 40 and 70%. Secondly, there was Palestinian depression. The violence ended normal life in the West Bank and Gaza. Hospitals were closed, transportation barely moved, schools were shut. Life had ground to a halt. And third, there was Palestinian recruitment woes. Israeli terrorism countermeasures are effective. Less and less people are being recruited as suicide bombers. Terrorism is not working. It takes a toll on the Palestinians without having its intended effect on Israel. So at this point in time, 2002, September, support for Yasser Arafat had fallen to a record low. Only 34% support him. Only one-third of the Palestinians supported him at that time. Former supporters held him responsible for the state of chaos and corruption found in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Arafat's biggest blow came when the Palestinian cabinet resigned, refusing to endorse Arafat's cabinet as inefficient and corrupt. Jabril Rajoub, the fired security chief, was particularly vocal with his criticisms. Severe criticism focused on Arafat's personal wealth, estimated at $1.3 billion. Okay, did you hear me right? Not M, not million dollars, 1.3 B. $1.3 billion. And that is all of that has come from the West in its attempt to support the Palestinians financially. Page 328. Israeli sources state that in July, Arafat transferred $5 million to his wife in Paris. Notice the wife who had so stridently said that she was a Palestinian patriot, doesn't live in Ramallah, doesn't live in the West Bank, doesn't live in Gaza. She lives in Paris with a paltry $5 million to help her to barely get along. The $5 million, the funds were provided by Saudi Arabia for assistance to Palestinian people. Apparently only one Palestinian person was assisted by the $5 million, Arafat's wife. Other leading Palestinians have transferred tens of millions to private bank accounts abroad, as fears grow that the PA would collapse. The second-ranking PA official, Abu Mazen, channeled $70 million in PA funds to European banks through his brother. Who is Abu Mazen, you guys? Well, here he is, Abu Mazen, also known as Mahmoud Abbas. This is the number two man, the number two man in the Palestinian Authority. He transferred $70 million to European banks through his brother. He's no different than Yasser Arafat. Reports of these transfers have been reported in Arabic newspapers as well. However, after a six-week lull in homicide bombings, a tribute to the effective Israeli countermeasures, two terrorists struck in northern Israel and in Tel Aviv. In response, the Israeli army besieged Arafat's compound in Ramallah once again and destroyed every building except the one housing Arafat himself. The army demanded the arrest of 19 men sheltered in the compound. After 11 days, President Bush demanded an end to the siege in order to gain support for the U.S. plans to invade Iraq. So Israel agreed and lifted the siege. Analysts stated that Israel's strategy to isolate Arafat backfired. The siege sparked pro-Arafat demonstrations and revived his image as the symbol of Palestinian suffering and resistance. All right, November 2002, middle of the page 328, Pastor Bob Morris of Hadavar Messianic Ministries spends 3 weeks in Israel volunteering for the IDF Medical Corps. The world's media does not notice. Yes, left out in the cold. Well, anyway, yes, I did visit Israel in November of 2002. As part of the SARL volunteer program, the IDF SARL volunteer program. It was a great 3 weeks. I recommend the SARL program to anyone who would like to spend 3 weeks in Israel. And so here is a picture of me in my IDF uniform. The blue and white patch on my shoulder signifies that I am a volunteer with Volunteers for Israel. This is our group, a group of Christians who went to the IDF Medical Corps base. We were volunteers at the Medical Corps base near Tel Aviv. This was our madracha, Mary Siegel. The madracha is the guide. Madrik means the guide. So she was one of the soldiers who was assigned to our care and comfort, take care of us. And here is our madrik, Boris Schindler. So Mary and Boris were our primary guides, primary soldiers that oversaw us and made sure we didn't get into trouble, made sure all our needs were taken care of. They were great, a couple of great kids. We really appreciated them. Now, going on the SARL program is rugged. Well, it's rustic. Maybe that'd be a better word. Here is my barracks with four of the guys. There were six of us in those barracks, and here are four of us enjoying the comfort of Israeli military life. One of my work assignments was with Dr. Don on the left and Rod on the right, two of the members of the group. We worked for Mashiach. Mashiach is the Israeli in the center, the man in with the white shirt on in the center. Mashiach, yes, that's his name. His name is Messiah. His parents had great hopes for him. He was a wonderful guy, didn't have good English, but we worked for him for most of the time. We were packing Ringer's solution, which is an artificial blood substitute. So that was in his warehouse. So we enjoyed our time with Mashiach. And we also not only packed Ringer solution, but here Dr. Don in the center and Rod on the right and myself on the left are packing some other medical equipment in the warehouse, getting it ready to go out to the medical corps. Here's Isaac. This is Isaac. Isaac was in charge of surgical instruments. And so I spent a couple of days working in Isaac's office, sterilizing surgical instruments, getting them ready to go out to the field or to go to hospitals to be ready for use during during combat. So I enjoyed Isaac, too. We had a good relationship as well. So that was my my 3 weeks with the IDF Medical Corps. I enjoyed it tremendously. Our next heading is November 2002, Abba Eban dies. And, of course, this is former Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban. And you are very familiar with him due to the video series that we have been watching that is called Israel, a Nation is Born, in which he gives an up-close and personal account of diplomacy and politics in the early years of the nation. Abba Eban was a significant contributor to the history of Israel, as I'm sure you can see now. So he passed away in November 2002. And that brings us to the year 2003 on page 328, and that probably is a good stopping point at this point. So let's call it quits for today. And we'll pick it up next week at the year 2003 on page 328.